But first, Nobel laureate psychologist Daniel Kahneman. He believes most of us don't understand the first thing about how we think. We make decisions, but don't know how. We remember some things and forget others, but don't know why. Kahneman went out on a limb recently and put some of his own ideas into a book for a popular audience. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow. Kahneman was so worried about how his professional colleagues would respond that he paid four of them $2,000 each to read the manuscript to see if it was worth publishing. Their response? Keep writing. Daniel Kahneman tells Steve Paulson there are two basic systems that drive the way we think.
Well, let me first apologize and say there are no systems, really, in the sense of interactive parts. But there is a set of mental operations that are carried out automatically. When you see something, when a two-year-old child points and says, doggy, something is happening, that seems to be experienced passively. It's something that happens to you. As we see the world, we don't decide to see the world. When we see a word on a poster, we read that word and we don't decide to read it. So there are many activities of that kind. When I say capital of Russia, a word came to your mind. When I say 2 + 2, a word came to your mind. All of these things happen by themselves and feel as if they were happening by themselves.
So there's something sort of instantaneous about it, which it sounds like it has something to do with pattern recognition.
It is pattern recognition, a lot of it. It is recognition. It is instantaneous, or at least it is very quick, and it happens automatically. It is not deliberate. It doesn't feel like something we do. In contrast, there are other mental activities that feel like something we do. We are the author of it. So if you try to compute the product of 17 by 24, well, in the first place, you've got to decide to do it. And then when you do it, you are following a program and you're doing that deliberately and you feel that you are the author of your own actions. So subjectively, it's quite different. And it's those two classes of operations that I described as system one does this and system two does that.
So system two is, I guess, what we would call conscious reasoning?
Yes, and system two is something else, actually. I lumped with system two another set of operations, which are control operations. We don't say anything that comes to mind. We direct our attention to some things and we direct it away from other things. So we are controlling ourselves. And that control operation is also joined with system two, and the characteristic they share in common is that they are deliberate and also they're effortful. They can be impaired when you're busy. So my rule about system two is that the definition of an operation of system two, that it's something you cannot do while you're making a left turn into traffic because we are limited in our ability to exert effort. And both deliberate computations and self-control demand effort.
Well, you have a very curious comment in your book. You say that although System 2 believes itself to be where the action is, the automatic System 1 is the hero of your book.
It certainly is, and I think it is the hero of our mental life, too. I mean, in the sense that most of the day, what we do is very largely skilled and automatic, and most of what we do all day is quite good because we're skilled at what we do and skilled activities belong with system one. Now, when we think of who we are and of what we experience ourselves thinking deliberately. We experience ourselves doing things voluntarily. And so our experience is very closely linked to system two. Much of what happens that I call system one activities are really unconscious. We're not aware of what's going on. We're not aware of what's going on within our memory. As a word is said and all the associations of that word are activated in memory, we're not aware of that process at all. And so we are biased to think that we are our system two. But in fact, our system two, most of the time, does what is suggested by system one. It just endorses.
Now, the obvious question is whether we should basically trust system one, these kind of instinctive, intuitive responses, or whether we should try to check them more often because they're actually not very reliable.
Well, very clearly, we have very little option in this matter. System two could not carry us through the day. Deliberation and thinking are costly and ineffective, And mostly we have to trust our habits and we have to trust our perceptions and we have to trust our impressions.
But you say, I mean, much of your research has shown that a lot of those natural tendencies to trust our observations, they feed biases that are often actually very inaccurate.
Absolutely correct. I mean, System One, it has a model of the world, but the model of the world that it operates in is very simplified. And System One is a machine for jumping to conclusions. So it operates on very little information as if it had more information. We're very rarely sensitive to what we don't know. We operate on whatever we know. We make the best story possible. And then there is a very striking characteristic of System One. It is rarely stumped. That is, when System One faces a question that it cannot answer, it spontaneously will come up with the answer to another question, to a simpler one that it does have an answer to. And it is this process of answering the wrong question that very frequently leads to the mistakes that I've been studying.
Give me one or two examples of this, how System One comes to the wrong conclusion.
Well, suppose you ask people, they're about to travel abroad, and you offer insurance and ask how much they would be willing to pay for insurance. And in one case, the insurance is for something that happens during the trip, is for death for any reason. And in the other case, you offer them a policy that covers death in a terrorist incident. That study was done when there was a fair amount of terrorism in Europe, and it was done in the United States. People pay more for the second policy than for the first.
Even though the first presumably would include the second, right?
It would include the second, and it would include many other forms of death which are a lot more likely than dying in an incident. But what happens is this. What we do when we buy insurance is we measure how afraid we are. That's a simpler question than how much should I be willing to pay for insurance. So I first check what comes to mind immediately is the reaction, which is basically the intensity of the fear that I experience. And then you map that intensity of fear into a number, an amount of dollars that you're willing to pay for insurance. That is answering the wrong question.
You have a number of fascinating stories that you tell in your book, and one of them is about an experience you had when you were doing national service in the Israeli army. It was a test called the Leaderless Group Challenge. Can you describe this?
Yes, I can. As part of my service, I was involved in the selection of candidates for officer training school. And one of the tests that we have was a leaderless challenge. And the way that it was run, it was run in an obstacle course, and you would bring a group of 8 soldiers. You removed all insignia of rank, so they didn't know what rank they had. You faced them with a wall. There was a telephone pole right next to them. You told them to pick up the telephone pole, which they did, and then you gave them their instructions, which were to get to the other side of the wall without the pole touching the wall or the ground and without anybody touching the wall. If either of these things happened, they had to start over. Very stressful exercise. There is no leader. It's a difficult task. It quite often was very hot and dusty and sweaty. And they've got to operate as a group and to decide what to do. And then you have the observers, and I was one of the observers. As an observer, the thing that is very striking is that you see people's natures revealed because they're under intense stress, and some of them appear to be leaders and strong, and others appear to be wimps, and others are just followers, and others are actually nasty. And all of this you can see because you feel that under the stress of the moment, truth is revealed. So that's one experience that we had there. There was another experience that occasionally, every few weeks, we would have a statistics day. And on that day, we would be told how well we were doing in predicting the achievements of those people that we did send to officer training school. And the answer was always the same. We had no idea. We couldn't do it.
So you thought you had picked the good leaders, and actually you had not.
We had not. But the third part of the story is the interesting one. Is this with the army? And so, you know, whether we believed or not that we're doing something useful, they would bring the next bunch of recruits the next day, and we'd take them to the obstacle field, we'd face them to the wall, pick the phone pole. 5 minutes later, we would see their true natures revealed. So with the same confidence that we had before we knew the statistics. So you can know that you don't know. You can have the statistics about your own performance, but the emotion, the sense of the compelling sense that you understand something that we had watching these people struggling with the task was not affected at all by learning the statistics. That, to some extent, set me off on my career. I coined a term for it. I called it the illusion of validity, and many years later, I studied it.
Which is to say that we are often confident or overconfident when we really shouldn't be based on the way the world really works.
In almost every way, we tend to be overconfident. And the reason is that system one, or associative memory, generates interpretations of situations that tend to be much more coherent than reality. So it neglects ambiguities, it suppresses ambiguities. So we have overconfidence that way. We have a sense that the world is understandable and predictable because anything that happens, we have a story about it. And so, you know, there is a financial crisis, and then there is a pretty clear theory that we're inclined to believe in about how the financial crisis came about. That gives us a sense that the financial crisis was knowable in advance, and it wasn't.
So the question, I suppose, that comes out of this research is there anything we can do based on your findings that somehow improves our judgments, our sense of how to tap into our better selves and to put aside those ways that we delude ourselves?
If my description of things is correct, more or less, there is essentially one thing you can do, which is to slow yourself down and, you know, bring in the reinforcement of system two. And we can't do that a lot because system two is just too slow. We must trust ourselves most of the time. When the stakes are high, it may be useful to slow yourself down. And there is something else that we can do, is we can help others make better decisions. You know, I describe my book as an attempt to educate gossip. That is, it's an attempt to allow people to think more intelligently about the judgments and experiences of others, because gossip is a pleasant activity, it's painless, and you can make it interesting. And I think a world in which people understand how other people make judgments and decisions is ultimately going to be a world in which better judgments and decisions are made, because we do anticipate the gossip of others. And if we anticipate intelligent gossip, we are more likely to make intelligent decisions.
Daniel Kahneman is the author of Thinking Fast and Slow. He received the 2002 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences for his pioneering work with Amos Tversky on decision-making. Kahneman spoke with Steve Paulson.